dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Corporations are the dominant institutions of our age, as we heard last week in part one of The Corporation. And they go to great lengths to portray themselves as deserving their status as a result of the benefits they create for all, as we will hear in part two of The Corporation this week. One of the repeated complaints of the corporate world is their oppression by government and law. But how true is this? To what extent are they the de facto government as a result of their power and influence? I'd like to start by reading you a story that appeared on February 10th in the Los Angeles Times. U.S. scientists say they are told to alter findings, by Julie Cart. More than 200 scientists employed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service say they've been directed to alter official findings to lessen protections for plants and animals, a survey released Wednesday says. The survey of the agency's scientific staff of 1,400 had a 30% response rate and was conducted jointly by the Union of Concerned Scientists and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. A division of the Department of the Interior, the Fish and Wildlife Service, is charged with determining which animals and plants should be placed on the endangered species list and designating areas where such species need to be protected. More than half of the biologists and other researchers who responded to the survey said they knew of cases in which commercial interests, including timber, grazing, development, and energy companies, had applied political pressure to reverse scientific conclusions deemed harmful to their business. Bush administration officials, including Craig Manson, an assistant secretary of the Interior who oversees the Fish and Wildlife Service, have been critical of the 1973 Endangered Species Act, contending that its implementation has imposed hardships on developers and others, while failing to restore healthy populations of wildlife. Along with Republican leaders in Congress, the administration is pushing to revamp the act. The president's proposed budget calls for a $3 million reduction in funding of Fish and Wildlife's endangered species programs. The pressure to alter scientific reports for political reasons has become pervasive at fish and wildlife offices around the country, said Lexi Schultz of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mitch Snow, a spokesman for the Fish and Wildlife Service, said the agency had no comment on the survey, except to say that, quote, some of the basic premises just aren't so, close quote. The two groups that circulated the survey also made available memos from fish and wildlife officials that instructed employees not to respond to the survey, even if they did so on their own time. Snow said that the agency employees could not use work time to respond to outside surveys. Fish and wildlife scientists in 90 national offices were asked 42 questions and given space to respond in essay form in the mail-in survey sent in November. One scientist working in the Pacific region, which includes California, wrote, "I have been through the reversal of two listing decisions due to political pressure. Science was ignored and worse manipulated to build a bogus rationale for reversal of these listing decisions." Close quote. More than 20% of survey responders said they had been, quote, directed to inappropriately exclude or alter technical information. However, 69% said they had never been given such a directive. And although more than half of the respondents said they had been ordered to alter findings to lessen protection of species, nearly 40% said they had never been required to do so. Sally Steferud, a biologist who retired in 2002 after 20 years with the agency, said Wednesday she was not surprised by the survey results, saying she'd been ordered to change a finding on a biological opinion. Political pressures influenced the outcome of almost all the cases, she said. As a scientist, I would probably say you can't really trust the science coming out of the agency. A biologist in Alaska wrote in response to the survey, "It is one thing for the department to dismiss our recommendations. It is quite another to be forced under veiled threat of removal to say something that is counter to our best professional judgment." Don Lindberg, head of the Office of Giant Panda Conservation at the Zoological Society of San Diego, said it was unrealistic to expect federal scientists to be exempt from politics or pressure. "I've not stood in the shoes of any of those scientists," he said, "but it's not difficult for me to believe that there are pressures from those who are not happy with conservation objectives, and here I'm referring to development interests and others. But when it comes to altering data, that is a serious matter. I am really sorry to hear that scientists working for the service feel they have to do that. Changing facts to fit the politics, that is a very unhealthy thing. If I were a scientist in that position, I would just refuse to do it." The Union of Concerned Scientists and the Public Employee Group provided copies of the survey and excerpts from the essay-style responses. One biologist based in California who responded to the survey said in an interview with The Times that the Fish and Wildlife Service was not interested in adding any species to the endangered species list. "For biologists who do endangered species analysis, my experience is that the majority of them are ordered to reverse their conclusions if they favor a listing. There are other biologists who will do it if you won't," said the biologist, who spoke on condition of anonymity. And that from the February 10th Los Angeles Times, U.S. scientists say they are told to alter findings, by Julie Cart.
In part one of this three-part series, we saw how the modern business corporation was ingeniously designed to create wealth for its owners while allowing them to escape responsibility for many of its harms. We heard critics inside and outside the corporate world who see this paradox as a fundamental design flaw which threatens the survival of every living being. Before we sample their proposed remedies, we consider the impacts of the corporation's relentless advance into every sphere of life, from the outer reaches of the atmosphere to the innermost depths of our DNA.
Corporation, a documentary by Mark Akbar, Jennifer Abbott, and Joel Bakken. Part 2, Planet Inc.
I gotta be honest with you, when the September 11th situation happened, I didn't know that, and I must say, and I wanna say this because it's
Carlton Brown, commodities trader.
I want to take it lightly. It's not a light situation. It's a devastating act. It was really a bad thing. It was one of the worst things I've seen in my lifetime, you know. But I will tell you, and every trader will tell you, who was not in that building and who was buying gold and who owned gold and silver, that when it happened, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up? The first thing that came to mind was, my God, gold must be exploding. Fortunately for us, all our clients were in gold. So when it went up, they all doubled their money. All I could think about was getting them the hell out. I mean, until we found out the building was collapsing. But before the building collapsed, all we were thinking about was, let's get those clients out. They've all doubled their money. Unfortunately, we couldn't get them out right then because the markets closed right afterwards. And then in the next couple of days, we got them all out. They all doubled their money. Everybody doubled their money. It was a blessing in disguise. Devastating, crushing, heart-shattering, but on a financial sense, for the, my clients that were in the market, they all made money. Now, I wasn't looking for this type of help. But it happened. When the U.S. bombed Iraq, back in 1991, the price of oil went from $13 to $40 a barrel, for Christ's sake. Now, we couldn't wait for the bombs to start raining down on Saddam Hussein. We were all excited. We wanted Saddam to really create problems. Do whatever you have to do. Set fire to some more oil wells because the price is going to go higher. Every broker was chanting that. There was not a broker that I know of that wasn't excited about that. And then all of a sudden they said the war is going to be over a lot faster than we thought. We were all thinking this thing could drag out for a couple of months here. Prices could really get out of hand. It could get to $50, $60, $70, $80. People were talking $70, $80. But we were excited about it because this was a disaster. This was something that was, you know, catastrophe happening, bombing, wars. In devastation, there is opportunity.
The pursuit of profit is an old story, but there was a time when many things were regarded either as too sacred or too essential for the public good to be considered business opportunities. They were protected by tradition and public regulation.
The Corporation, Boundary Issues. Jeremy Rifkin, President, Foundation for Economic Trends.
We can really begin to take a look at the emergence of the modern age with the enclosure movements of the great European commons in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century. Medieval life was a collectively lived life. It was a brutish, nasty affair, but there was a collective responsibility. People belonged to the land did not belong to people. And in this European world, people farmed the land in a collective way because they saw it as a commons. It belonged to God. And then it was administered by the church, the aristocracy, and then the local manors as stewards of God's creation. Beginning with Tudor England, we began to see a phenomenon emerge, and that is the enclosure of the great commons by parliamentary acts in England and then in Europe. And so first we began to take the great land masses of the world, which were commons and shared, and we reduced those to private property. Then we went after the oceans, the great oceanic commons, and we created laws and regulations that would allow countries to claim a certain amount of water outside their coastal limits for exploitation. In this century, we went after the air, and we divided it into air corridors that could be bought and sold for commercial traffic for airplanes. And then, of course, the rest is history.
Elaine Bernard, Executive Director, Trade Union Program.
With deregulation, privatization, free trade, what we're seeing is yet another enclosure and, if you like, private taking of the commons. One of the things I find very interesting in our current debates is this concept of who creates wealth. That wealth is only created when it's owned privately. What would you call clean water, fresh air, a safe environment? Are they not a form of wealth? And why does it only become wealth when some entity puts a fence around it and declares it private property? Well, you know, that's not wealth creation, that's wealth usurpation.
Mark Kingwell.
Over the centuries, we have put more and more things in that public realm, and lately, just lately, in the last, let's say, three or four decades, started pulling them out again. So, firefighters, for instance.
This man needs the fire department.
Firefighters started as private companies.
Yes, and lots of other people need the fire department, too.
And if you didn't have the medallion of a given firefighter brigade on your house and it was on fire, those firefighters would just, you know, ride on by because you didn't have a deal. Well, we gradually evolved a public trust for the provision of safety on that very specific level. This is important. We should not go back from that and start saying, well, you know, why don't we put that back in the market and see what that does? Maybe it'll make it more efficient. No, there are some things where we should not tinker with a public trust for the sake of what might be a marginal gain in efficiency and might well not be.
Mark Kingwell. Noam Chomsky Institute Professor, MIT.
A privatization does not mean you take a public institution and give it to some nice person. It means you take a public institution and give it to an unaccountable tyranny. Public institutions have many side benefits. For one thing, they may purposely run at a loss. They're not out for profit. They may purposely run at a loss because of the side benefits. So, for example, if a public steel industry runs at a loss, it's providing cheap steel to other industries. Maybe that's a good thing. Public institutions can have a countercyclic property. So that means that they can maintain employment in periods of recession, which increases demand, which helps you get out of a recession. Private company can't do that. You know, in a recession, throw out the workforce. That's the way you make money. And there are lots of other side effects like this, which aren't calculated by economists. It's not part of the heavily ideological constructed system called economics, which measures certain things and doesn't measure other things.
Every time a forest falls, the GNP goes up. With every oil spill, the GNP goes up. Every time a new cancer patient is diagnosed, the GNP goes up. If we are to save ourselves, economists must learn to subtract.
There are those who intend that one day everything will be owned by somebody.
Maud Barlow, Council of Canadians.
And we're not just talking goods here. We're talking human rights, human services, essential services for life, education, public health, social assistance, pensions, housing. We're also talking about the survival of the planet, the areas that we believe must be maintained in the commons or under common control, or we will collectively die. Water and air.
Even in the case of air, there's been some progress, and that is the trading of pollution permits.
Michael Walker, the Fraser Institute, a market solutions think tank.
And here the idea is to say, look, we can't avoid the dumping of carbon dioxide. We can't avoid the dumping of sulfur oxides. At least we can't at the moment afford to stop doing that. So we're dumping a certain amount of stuff into the environment. So we're going to say, with the current tonnage of sulfur oxides, for example, we will say that is the limit, and we'll create permits for that amount. We'll give them to the people who've been doing the polluting, and now we will permit them to be traded. And so now, there's a price attached to polluting the environment. Now, wouldn't it be marvelous if we had one of those prices for everything?
It sounds like you're advocating private ownership of every square inch of the planet.
Absolutely.
Every cubic foot of air, water.
It sounds outlandish to say we want to have the whole universe, the whole of the Earth, owned. That doesn't mean I want to have Joe Bloggs owning this square foot, but it means that the interests that are involved in that stream are owned by some group or by some people who have an interest in maintaining it. And that, you know, that is not such a loony idea. It's in fact the solution to a lot of these problems.
The corporation, basic training.
Imagine a world in which one of the things owned by a corporation was the song Happy Birthday. In fact, an AOL Time Warner subsidiary holds the copyright. In the past, it has demanded over $10,000 to allow you to hear anyone sing this popular song in a film. We didn't pay. We preferred to use the money to fly our crew to Boston and Los Angeles to bring you the following story.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Off into space. Man, that takes real teamwork. And here's a team of junior spacemen with an out-of-this-world breakfast.
Comparing the marketing of yesteryear to the marketing of today is like comparing a BB gun to a smart bomb.
Susan Lin, professor of psychiatry, Baker Children's Center, Harvard.
It's not the same as when I was a kid, or even when the people who are young adults today were kids. It's much more sophisticated, and it's much more pervasive. It's not that products themselves are bad or good. It's the notion of manipulating children into buying the products. In 1998, Western International Media, Century City, and Lieberman Research Worldwide conducted a study on nagging.
We asked parents to keep a diary for 3 weeks and to record every time, you could imagine, every time their child nagged them for a product. We asked them to record when, where, and why.
This study was not to help parents cope with nagging. It was to help corporations help children nag for their products more effectively.
After that 3 week period, we followed up with a telephone interview to find out what they had actually bought, so that we could link the two components together, the nagging with the purchasing behavior.
Lucy Hughes, Vice President of Initiative Media, co-creator of The Nag Factor.
Anywhere from 20% to 40% of purchases would not have occurred unless the child had nagged their parents. That is, we found, for example, a quarter of all visits to theme parks wouldn't have occurred unless a child nagged the parents. 4 out of 10 visits to places like Chuck E. Cheese would not have occurred. And any parent would understand that. You know, when I think of Chuck E. Cheese, oh my goodness, it's noise. And there's so many kids. Why would I want to spend 2 hours there? But if the child nags enough, you're going to go. We saw the same thing with movies, with home video, with fast food. You can make somebody stay. We do have to break through this barrier where they do tell us, or they say they don't like it when their kids nag. Well, that's just a general attitude that they possess. It doesn't mean that they necessarily act upon it 100% of the time. You can manipulate consumers into wanting and therefore buying your products. It's a game.
Susan Lin, professor of psychiatry.
Children are not little adults. Their minds aren't developed. And what's happening is that marketers are playing to their developmental vulnerabilities.
Everything that a kid sees that makes such a deep impression on his mind, they recognize me wherever they see me.
The advertising that children are exposed to today is honed by psychologists. It's enhanced by media technology that nobody ever thought was possible.
The more insight you have about the consumer, the more creative you'll be in your communication strategies. So if that takes a psychologist, yeah, we want one of those on staff.
I'm not saying that it's wrong to make things for children. You know, and I also think it's important to distinguish between psychologists who work on products for children, who help, you know, toy corporations make toys that are developmentally appropriate. I think that's great. That's different from selling the toys directly to the children.
Absolutely, the whole gamut of products are targeted to kids today.
A poll in USA Today said something like 73% of parents say that they feel that they can't protect their children from popular culture or corporate culture.
Initiative is huge. I think in the U.S. we place about $12 billion of media time. So we'll put it on TV, we'll put it in print, we'll put it out in outdoor, we'll buy radio time. So we're the biggest buyers of advertising time and space in the U.S. and in the world.
One family cannot combat an industry that spends $12 billion a year trying to get their children. They can't do it.
They are tomorrow's adult consumers, so start talking with them now, build that relationship when they're younger, and you've got them as an adult. Somebody asked me, Lucy, is that ethical? You're essentially manipulating these children. Well, yeah, is it ethical? I don't know. But our role at Initiative is to move products. And if we know you move products with a certain creative execution, place in a certain type of media vehicle, then we've done our job.
Mark Kingwell, philosopher.
Every institution provides the people who are members of it with a social role. to occupy. And typically, institutions that are vibrant and have a lot of power will specify that role in some sense as a list of virtues. So the military virtues of courage and honor and loyalty and deference to authority, we can cash this out as a role that we occupy in that sense as the good soldier or the good officer. And the same is true for churches, for schools, for any institution that has power over people and shapes them.
One nation.
The corporation, likewise, it provides us with a list of virtues, a kind of social role, which is the good consumer.
Like the waters of a mighty ocean, people also represent a tremendous force, the understanding of which is of greatest importance to the American way of life. This force is known as consumer power.
Noam Chomsky.
The goal for the corporations is to maximize profit and market share, and they also have a goal for their target, namely the population. They have to be turned into completely mindless consumers of goods that they do not want. You have to develop what are called created wants. So you have to create wants. You have to impose on people what's called a philosophy of futility. You have to focus them on the insignificant things of life, like fashionable consumption. I'm just basically quoting business literature. And it makes perfect sense. The ideal is to have individuals who are totally dissociated from one another, whose conception of themselves, the sense of value, is just how many created wants can I satisfy?
General Motors public relations film.
These people are customers because they are willing to trade money for widgets. And all the customers take their widgets home to all parts of the country. Look at all that money the widget builder has taken in from the sale of his widgets.
We have huge industries. Public relations industry is a monstrous industry. Advertising and so on is, which are designed from infancy to try to mold people into this desired pattern.
I saw a homeless person in New York City, and he had like a TV set up, and people were going up and trying to get pictures with him, and they wanted to like be there. And if he had like a company sponsor him, then that might be kind of interesting, and like Polaroid could sponsor it and give out free pictures or something like that. I don't know, it'd just be a possibility for someone who doesn't have that many possibilities.
Chris Barrett and Luke McCabe, corporate-sponsored university students.
I saw Tiger Woods on TV with a hat with a Nike logo on it. And we figured, you know, he probably gets like millions of dollars just to wear the hat on the press conference. And therefore, we figured we can do that for someone else and hopefully get money in turn so we can go to school. And that's how we came up with being corporately sponsored.
We made our sponsor announcement on Today Show on June 18th.
We're thrilled to be sponsored by First USA. We're thrilled to be working with First USA as our corporate sponsor, and they're covering our college tuition to found First USA as our sponsor, and we're proud to be working with them. Our sponsor is First USA, so we're really thrilled to announce First USA as our sponsor. We're thrilled to be working with First USA.
And so we give First USA a good name in the media and include them in our news stories, and then through there they get as much advertising as we can give them.
They'll be conforming not to the wishes of demanding parents, but to the wishes of an image-conscious corporation.
They're not just out there for the money, and they're just, I mean, they want to work with us and be our friends and let us help them help us and vice versa.
We became walking billboards to pay for our college tuition.
Cool Site of the Day picked us as Cool Site, and Yahoo picked us, and we were in USA Today.
When we did our photo shoot for People magazine, this is where we stood. Up on top.
We stood up here and we smiled.
We smiled and took the picture.
Our parents had more stories and stuff to tell us. We have our corporate sponsor story.
Exactly. I mean, I have a lot of faith in the corporate world because it's always going to be there, so you may as well have faith in it, because if you don't, then it's just not good.
Chris and Luke's success depends on spreading their faith in their sponsor of the moment. But not everyone on the Fortune 500 payroll is obliged to be a good apostle. Some are hired for their willingness to break the commandments.
The corporation, soldier of fortune, 500. Mark Berry, competitive intelligence professional.
You know, I like to be able to go out and have a nice dinner with someone, and the truth of the matter is there's so much trickery and deception in my private, in my job, that I really don't want it in my private life. It's not easy making the distinction. There are some women walking the world that will tell you that I haven't quite made that distinction yet. The way you live with yourself when you do this, you have to have a very compartmentalized life. Essentially, I'm a spy. My work spans all industry sectors. I mean, I virtually have worked for, like, I'd say 25% of the Fortune 500. At a time where you have these multinational corporations that just, you know, span the globe and whose profits are larger than some countries' gross national product, I mean, there's so much on the line that competition is everything. It's really something to be standing outside of, like, Xerox, looking up at this giant building saying, you know, how am I gonna get, you know, the schematics for the new inkjet printer? You know, that's not easy to do. And so that's why I like it. It, to me, it's a challenge. And sometimes it's even more fun when they know I'm coming. If they've heard that I've been hired, or they've been, the security director calls me up to put me on notice because I've been seen in the area or whatever. I mean, it's actually fun. I've posed as an investment banker. I've posed as a venture capitalist. I'll locate your employees, and I will tell them that I'm calling from Acme Recruiting Agency and that I've got a job that pays them considerably more than what they're paying. Would they mind meeting me for an interview? And when the executive shows up, what he doesn't realize is I'm actually debriefing him on behalf of a competitor, and that there is no job, and that the office that he's at has been rented, and the picture on my desk of my family is a phony, and it's all just a big elaborate ruse to glean competitive information from him. I don't feel any guilt. It's, you know what? I mean, you have to expect that guys like me are out there. We're predators. It's about competition. I mean, it's about market share. It's about being aggressive. It's about shareholder value. What is your stock at today? If you're a CEO, I mean, do you think your shareholders really care whether you're Billy Buttercup or not? You know, do you think that they really... they would prefer you to be a nice guy over having money in their pocket? I don't think so. I think people want money. That's the bottom line. I have a nickname as being the kite. It's a derogatory intelligence term, and it basically means someone who's expendable. The premise being you can fly the kite out there to collect whatever information you want, and if the storm comes on the horizon, in the form of, say, a lawsuit or, you know, some sort of, you know, criminal justice prosecution or something, well, then you can just cut the string and walk away. And there's plausible deniability because the kite is off flying by itself and you had no knowledge of what it was doing.
The corporation, perception management.
Some of the best creative minds are employed to assure our faith in the corporate worldview. They seduce us with beguiling illusions designed to divert our minds and manufacture our consent.
Richard Grossman, co-founder, program on corporation law and democracy.
Corporations don't advertise products particularly. They're advertising a way of life, a way of thinking, you know, a story of you know, who we are as people and how we got here and what's the source of our so-called liberty and our so-called freedom. You know, so you have decades and decades and decades of propaganda and education teaching us to think in a certain way. When applied to the large corporation, it's that the corporation was inevitable, that it's indispensable, that it somehow is remarkably efficient, and that it is responsible for progress and a good life.
Chris Komisarjevsky, CEO, Burstyn Marsteller, a global public relations firm.
Perception management is a very interesting concept. It's basically a methodology which helps us when we work with our clients to go through a very systematic, thoughtful process in order to be able to help our clients identify what the resources are that they have, what the barriers to their success are, and how we can use communications to help them accomplish their objectives.
Past client, Union Carbide, public relations after Bhopal gas leak, up to 20,000 dead.
If Michael or Angelica came to me and said, Dad, what do you do and why is it important? My answer to that question is basically that I help corporations have a voice.
Past client, Philip Morris, organized the National Smokers Alliance to fight anti-smoking laws.
I help corporations share the point of view about how they feel about things.
Richard Grossman.
They're selling themselves, they're selling their domination, they're selling their rule, and they're creating an image for themselves as just regular folks down the block.
Hi, how you all doing today?
Tom Klein, Senior Vice President, Pfizer Incorporated, world's largest pharmaceutical corporation.
We're from Pfizer. We're your neighbors. You're in the new houses? Are you in the new houses? Oh, these are some neighbors. Well, can we say hello? Can we say hello just for a minute? So, what do you think of the neighborhood now?
It's all right. It's good.
Yeah, I think it's been getting better over the last 20 years that I've been coming here. Yeah. So I think together, you know, working with you and Pfizer and our other partnership will make this a better place. Okay. Nice to see you, Ms. Frazier. Bye. There used to be a lot of crime at this subway. One night as I was going home, I got caught and was almost mugged. And so we decided to make a change to make this community better. We're looking at turnstiles that prevent fare beating. It used to be that you could just hop right over. So Pfizer, in collaboration with the Transit Authority, actually purchased these machines. This is one of four cameras that were installed here by the Pfizer Corporation in collaboration with the New York City Police Department. This is a talkback box that allows us to speak to the Pfizer guard, which is approximately 500 yards from here. Now, I haven't seen the Pfizer guard today, but I'm going to see if I can call him. If he's not, I'll have to go wake him up. Hello, hello, Tom Klein speaking. So I'm sure before we're through, he'll call back. But particularly on the off hours, this allows a passenger to call directly to the Pfizer desk for assistance. And then the Pfizer guard calls the transit police, and the transit police respond to any crime situation. As a result of all this, crime is down in the station. It's much safer for our community partners. Thank you. I'm going to press the other button just to be sure. Tom speaking. Hello. We'll stop over and see him personally.
Jack, how are you doing?
Good. Would it be okay if could you just, while we take the picture, could you just move aside for a
minute? No, okay, you want to take a picture?
Yeah, wait. It'll take about 10 minutes. Okay. Love you, huh? Always say hello to my friends. Thank you. Appreciate it. Sorry to bother you. Thanks. This is what our community used to look like, and now our community is better.
Richard Grossman.
It's tough, you know. They're putting, you know, some taxpayer and shareholder money into helping and who can say. But that money should be going to the taxpayers to decide what to do. And while they're doing those sort of nice things, they're also playing a role in lowering taxes for corporations and lowering taxes for wealthy people, you know, and reconfiguring public policy. What we don't see is all that reconfiguring going on. We don't see them vacuuming out the money, vacuuming out the insides of public processes. But we do see the nice facade.
The Corporation, a Private Celebration. Naomi Klein, author, No Logo.
When I was researching the takeover of public space, when I started off, I thought, okay, this is just advertising. We've always had advertising. It's just more advertising. But what I started to understand and what I understand now is that branding is not advertising, it's production. And very successful corporations, the corporations of the future, do not produce products. They produce brand meaning. The dissemination of the idea of themselves is their act of production. And the dissemination of the idea of themselves is an enormously invasive project. So how do you make a brand idea real? Well, a good place to start is by building a three-dimensional manifestation of your brand. So that might be a superstore that is unlike any retail experience we've ever seen. For a company like Disney, it goes even further, where it's actually building a town, Celebration Florida.
Currently, there are about 5,000 residents who call Celebration home.
Andrea Finger, spokesperson, Celebration Florida.
And there are about 1,300 single-family homes, a town center that's a place where people gather that has about four or five restaurants and about a dozen other shops.
Their inspiration, their brand image, is the all-American family and the sort of bygone American town.
Clay Timon, CEO, Landon & Associates, world's top branding and design consultants.
Their brand driver is family magic, and everything that that company does is in and around those two words. If you take that, a branded environment such as a Disney World or a Disneyland is a logical extension of that brand. Film, animated film, family-oriented film is a very logical extension of that. As a business, though, they also know that if they want to get into other forms of entertainment that does not fit family magic, they do not brand it Disney. If they want to get into adult, more serious type fare, when it comes to film, they brand it Touchstone.
The Disney brand speaks of reassurance. It speaks of tradition. It speaks of quality. And you can see that here in this community that we've built.
Naomi Klein.
And that's where you see the truly imperialist aspirations of branding, which is about building these privatized branded cocoons, which maybe you start by shopping in and then you continue by holidaying in, but eventually, why not just move in?
The triumph of the shill.
What happens if we wake up one day and we find out that virtually all of our relationships that are mediated between us and our fellow human beings are commercial? We find out that virtually every relationship we have is a commercially arbitrated relationship with our fellow human being. Can civilization survive on that narrow a definition of how we interact with each other?
Wow, what a dream.
Jonathan Ressler, CEO, Big Fat Incorporated, undercover marketing specialist.
I could give you a day in the life of a person who might be the target of undercover marketing, and I will tell you that some of these things are happening right now around you. So you walk out of your building in the morning, some city, and you walk by the door and you say, hey, good morning, and you notice there's a bunch of boxes at his feet from some online or mail order retailer, and there's a bunch of boxes there with, of course, a big brand message on it. You walk out, and, well, a lot of people must be ordering from that company. But what you don't know is that we paid the doorman to keep those empty boxes there. So when you walk in and out, you notice those boxes and you think, hey, a lot of people are ordering from that online company. You walk out into the street, and you hear some people having kind of a loud conversation about a musical act. And they're kind of passing the headphones back and forth. They go, wow, this is great.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Hey, do you know that I heard this CD is really hard to find, but I heard they sell it at Store X.
I'm going to go pick it up. So
it's
good.
Great, isn't it?
Well, you hear that and you register it, and you know, you might kind of pick up on that. And maybe later on you'll think, hey, I wonder what the hot act is. Bang, that might be in your head. Now you get into your office, and there's a certain brand of water in the refrigerator. What is that? You take it out, you drink it, you slug it down, it's there, and not really thinking about it. Wow, that's pretty good water. Who knows? Maybe someone placed the water there. You kind of go out for your lunch break, you're sitting in the park, and people are kind of out there talking in the park, and bang, all of a sudden you see another message. By the time you go to bed, You've probably received 8 or 9 different undercover messages. People are always thinking, well, oh, I know product placement. That's when they put stuff in movies. Well, yes, kind of. I mean, that's definitely traditional product placement, but real life product placement is just that, placing stuff in movies, but the movie is actually your life. We'll take a group of attainable, but still aspirational people. They're not supermodels. They're kind of people just like you. They're doing something for us, whether they're having a certain kind of drink or they're using a certain laundry detergent, whatever it may be. They are kind of the Roach Motel, if you will. People are going to come over to them, and they're going to give them this little piece of brand bait. Could be a soundbite of knowledge or a ritual. Consumers would get that piece of roach bait, and then they would take it. They go, oh, pretty cool. And then they go out, and they spread it to their friends. Undercover marketing is happening everywhere. But I could be doing it to you right now. I might be getting paid to wear this brand of shirt. I mean, it really is happening everywhere. What? It happens in bars. It happens at soccer games. It happens in Little League baseball games. It happens in shopping malls. It happens in the subway. It happens in the movie theater. Anywhere where people are communicating with each other, it's happening there. If it's happening well, if they're doing it well, you don't know what's going on. It could be your brother. They sign a confidentiality agreement. They never talk about it. If you ask them, they're going to say no. If you want to be critical, if you want to go through your life like that, sure, be critical of every single person that walks up to you. But if they're showing you something that fits and something that works and something that makes your life better in some way, well, then who cares? We, again, just say thanks.
Today, the job of building this nation geographically is completed. There are no new frontiers within our borders. So, to what new horizons can we look now? Where are tomorrow's opportunities? What's ahead for you, for your children? The frontiers of the future are not on any map. They are in the test tubes and laboratories of the great industries.
The Corporation, Advancing the Front. Jeremy Rifkin.
The Jacobardi case was one of the great judicial moments in world history, and the public was totally unaware it was actually happening as the process was being engaged. General Electric and Professor Jacobardi went to the patent office with a little microbe that eats up oil spills. They said they had modified this microbe in the laboratory, and therefore it was an invention. The patent office, the U.S. government, took a look at this, quote, invention, and they said, no way. The patent statutes don't cover living things. This is not an invention. Turned down. Then General Electric and Dr. Jacobardi appealed to the U.S. Customs Court of Appeal. And to everyone's surprise, by a 3-2 decision, they overrode the patent office.
We bring good things to life.
And they said, this microbe looks more like a detergent or a reagent than a horse or a honeybee. I laughed because they didn't understand basic biology. It looked like a chemical to them. Had it had an antenna or eyes or wings or legs, it would never have crossed their table and been patented. Then the patent office appealed. And what the public should realize now is the patent office was very clear that you can't patent life. My organization provided the main amicus curiae brief. If you allow the patent on this microbe, we argued, it means that without any congressional guidance or public discussion, corporations will own the blueprints of life. When they made the decision, we lost by 5-4, and Chief Justice Warren Burger said, sure, some of these are big issues, but we think this is a small decision. 7 years later, the U.S. Patent Office issued a one-sentence decree. You can patent anything in the world that's alive except a full-birth human being.
The Supreme Court of the United States ruled today that living organisms produced in the laboratory may be patented. This decision to extend
the patent. The U.S. Supreme Court had to decide was whether one man or one company should be able to control new forms of life.
We allow any company or college to exclusively own a species. What does that say about our reverence for life?
Researchers at Harvard manipulated the genes of mice, making their offspring more susceptible to cancer. They patented the Harvard mouse in the U.S., Europe, and Japan.
They tried to do the legal battle that finally came to an end today. The Supreme Court of Canada ruled a genetically engineered mouse can't be patented.
Canadians don't think that life forms are inventions of industry like bulbs and widgets.
Scientists and drug companies search the planet for genes.
Companies scouring the planet looking for valuable DNA. Genes that can patent
DNA. We've
we've all been hearing about the announcement that we have mapped the human genome. But what the public doesn't know is now there's a great race by genomic companies and biotech companies and life science companies to find the treasure in the map. The treasure are the individual genes that make up the blueprint of the human race. Every time they capture a gene and isolate it, these biotech companies claim it as intellectual property. The breast cancer gene, the cystic fibrosis gene, it goes on and on and on. If this goes unchallenged in the world community, within less than 10 years, a handful of global companies will own directly or through license the actual genes that make up the evolution of our species. And they're now beginning to patent the genomes of every other creature on this planet. In the age of biology, the politics is going to sort out between those who believe life first has intrinsic value, and therefore we should choose technologies and commercial venues that honor the intrinsic value. And then we're going to have people who believe, well, look, life is simply a utility. It's commercial fare, and they will line up with the idea to let the marketplace be the ultimate arbiter of all of the age of biology.
In a world economy where information is filtered by global media corporations, keenly attuned to their powerful advertisers, who will defend the public's right to know? And what price must be paid to preserve our ability to make informed choices?
The Corporation, Unsettling Accounts. Steve Wilson, investigative reporter.
What Fox Television told us was that we were just the people to be the investigators.
Do any stories you want. Ask tough questions and get answers.
Jane Akre, investigative reporter.
So we thought, this is great. This is a dream job. Fantastic.
The very first thing they had us do was not to research stories, but to shoot this promo, which was the investigators.
Uncovering the truth. Getting results. Protecting you.
And they had a film crew and a smoke machine, and we were silhouetted.
Investigative reporter Steve.
One of the first stories that Jane came up with was the revelation that most of the milk in the state of Florida and throughout much of the country was adulterated with the effects of bovine growth hormone, the artificial hormone that farmers were injecting into their cows so that they would produce more milk.
With Monsanto, I didn't realize how effectively a corporation could work to get something on the marketplace. The levels of coordination they had to have. They had to get university professors into the fold. They had to get experts into the fold. They had to get reporters into the fold. They had to get the public into the fold. And of course, the FDA, let's not leave them out. They had to get the federal regulators convinced that this was a fine and safe product to get it onto the marketplace. And they did that. They did that very, very well.
It's a great time to be a high-producing cow. Posilac One Step, Bovine Somatotropin by Monsanto.
Monsanto promotional video.
The federal government basically rubber-stamped it before they put it on the marketplace. The longest test they did for human toxicity was 90 days on 30 rats.
Posilac is the single most tested new product in history and is now available to you specifically so you can increase your profit potential.
And then either Monsanto misreported the results to the FDA, or the FDA didn't bother to look in depth at Monsanto's own studies.
The scientists within Health Canada looked very carefully at bovine growth hormone and came to very different conclusions than the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. did.
Monsanto's engineered growth hormone did not comply with safety requirements. It could be absorbed by the body and therefore did have implications for human health. Mysteriously, that conclusion was deleted from the final published version of their report.
They knew there were problems. They saw serious potential human health problems, and they stood up in Canada and said, we're not going to approve this because we don't believe it's safe.
Dr. Shiv Chopra, Health Canada scientist.
We have been pressured and coerced to pass drugs of questionable safety, including the RBST. I personally was very concerned that there's a very serious problem of secrecy, conspiracy, and things of that nature, and something needs to be done.
The FDA was then on the hot seat. They had to come up with an answer. They didn't come up with a good one, and they never took the opportunity then. I mean, what would they do, pull it off the market and say, we need to now do the job that we didn't do the first time? They didn't do that.
We wrote the story. We had it ready a week beforehand. They bought ads.
Farmers in the milk industry say it's safe, but studies suggest a link to cancer. Don't miss this special report from the investigators.
That Friday night before the Monday this series was to begin, the fax machine spit out a letter from this very high-priced lawyer in New York that Monsanto had hired. It contained a lot of things that were just off the wall false, just demonstrably false. But if you didn't know the story and you didn't know how we had gone about producing it, it would have scared you as a broadcaster, as a manager.
And they decided that they would pull the story and they would just check it one more time.
But the bottom line was that there was no factual errors in that story. Both sides had been heard from. Both sides had had an opportunity to speak.
1 week later, Monsanto sent the second letter, and this was even more strongly worded. And it said there will be dire consequences for Fox News if the story airs in Florida. And this time they freaked. They were afraid of being sued, and they were also afraid of losing advertising dollars at all of the stations owned by Rupert Murdoch. And he owned more television stations than any other group in America. I mean, that's 22 television stations. That's a lot of advertising dollars for Roundup, Aspartame, NutraSweet, and other products.
So we got into a battle. And the first deal was the new general manager.
And his name's Dave. And Dave is a salesman. And, you know, he'd pump your hand. How you doing? How you doing?
Called us upstairs to his office and he said, what would you say if I killed this piece? What if it never ran? And we said, well, you know, we wouldn't be very happy about that. And he said, well, I could kill it, you know. And we said, yes, of course, you're the manager. You could kill it. It would never air. And he's hemming and he's hawing and he's back and he's forth. And we couldn't figure out, what is this all about? And finally he blurted out, look, would you tell anybody? You know, I said, I'm not going to lie for you. About a week later, calls us back to the office and says, okay, we'd like you to make these changes. In fact, you will make these changes. We said, well, look, let us show you the research that we have that shows that this information you want us to broadcast isn't true. To which he replies, I don't care about that. I said, pardon me? And he said, that's what I have lawyers for. Just write it the way the lawyers want it written. I said, you know, this is news. This is important. This is stuff people need to know. And I'll never forget, he didn't pause a beat, and he said, we just paid $3 billion for these television stations. We'll tell you what the news is. The news is what we say it is. I said, I'm not doing that. And he said, well, he said, if you refuse to present the story the way we think it should be presented, you'll be fired for insubordination. I said, I will go to the Federal Communications Commission and I will report that I was fired from my job by you, the licensee of these public airwaves, because I refused to lie to people on the air. And it's thank you very much. You'll hear from us right away. Well, 24 hours came and went, and we didn't hear a thing. And about a week later, he calls us back, and now we've changed strategies. How about if we pay you some money and you just go away? And I said, how much money? Because, you know, when somebody offers to bribe you like that, I always want to know if it might be worth it.
He was going to offer us the rest of our year's salary if we agreed not to talk about what Monsanto had done, to not talk about the Fox corporate response in suppressing the story, and to not talk about the story, not talk about BGH again, anywhere, not take the story to another news organization. Zip up.
I said, you mean if I want to go to my daughter's PTA meetings and explain what's in the school milk at the school lunch program? I can't, no. You can never speak about this anywhere.
And Steve says, okay, write it up. And I'm like, write it up? What are you talking about? Write it up. And I didn't say anything. And Dave, he wrote it up. And he FedExed it to us a couple days later. And he said, are you going to sign? And we said, nah, Dave, we're not going to sign that. And he said, we'll send it back, okay? I said, no, Dave, we're not going to send that back.
It was, okay, we can't buy you out. We can't shut you up. Let's get the story on the air in a way that we can all agree it will go on the air. And we started rewriting and editing with their lawyers.
Well, during this 8-month re-review process, I say jokingly, they did things like, for example, they wanted to take out the word cancer. You don't have to identify what the potential problem is, but just say human health implications. Any criticism of Monsanto or its product, they either removed it or minimized it.